Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Yunus and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello, and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. I'm Shelley Carney.
And I'm Toby Yunus. Thanks for joining us.
Today, we'll be diving into Chapter 17, titled Lizette. And if you remember, Miguel is on his way to Mardi Gras, riding his Uncle Carlos's motorcycle. He's driving through Texas. He got stopped by the sheriff. Then he continued on his way, and towards evening, he stopped at a hamburger stand, Billy Bob's hamburger stand, and he met Lizette, the owner of Billy Bob's, and she made him a burger and a shake and some fries, and then they had a nice conversation. She found out he was planning to spend the night out on the road in a pup tent, and she invited him to come stay in her house. So we left off where Miguel is about to enter Lizette's house. Are we ready?
We are.
All right. We enter the house through the back porch and walk into the kitchen where Lizette sets down her purse and keys. She points to the table saying, "Take a seat. Make yourself comfortable. There's some drinks in the fridge if you're thirsty." She leaves the room, I imagine, to change out of her work clothes. After the long day and the meal I just ate, I am thirsty, so I open the refrigerator to find a mixture of beer and soft drinks and a large glass jug full of water. I grab a bottle of Big Orange soda, notice a bottle opener screwed into the cabinet next to the refrigerator, and use it to open my drink. I take a long swig and bring it with me to sit back down at the kitchen table to relax. A few minutes later, Lizette returns to the kitchen, wearing a floral print house coat. She is barefoot, but her hair is still piled on top of her head in a way that is both disheveled and yet somehow organized. It reminds me of my mother, house coat and barefoot, her after-work look. Lizette has her cigarettes and matchbook in one hand and a glass ashtray in the other. She sets them on the table before going to the refrigerator for a bottle of beer, opening it with the same bottle opener I had used. She sits in a kitchen chair with one of her legs folded underneath her and lights a cigarette. Taking a draw, she exhales the smoke up toward the ceiling. I spend the next hour asking her questions and listening to stories about her life growing up in Central Texas. Her father was a rancher. She had gone to local schools all the way through high school. She was a barrel racer, all-around cowgirl, and a cheerleader. She had hopes of going to college at the University of Texas at Austin. A smooth-talking, handsome man and poor decisions on her part led to pregnancy and a marriage of convenience that didn't last past the first year. So instead of going off to college, she lived at home with her father, worked at Billy Bob's, and raised her baby boy all the way through his high school graduation. Between the inheritance from her father and the money she squirreled away, she planned for her son to go to the University of Texas at Austin. That was her big dream for him. It just wasn't his dream. On the day of his high school graduation, he informed her that he had signed a contract to join the U.S. Army with a guarantee he would attend Special Forces training at Fort Bragg. He wanted to be a Green Beret. He wanted to serve his country and see the world, and it was something he just had to do. The announcement broke her heart. She said that she cried the whole rest of the afternoon, trying to convince him to change his mind. But he calmed her down, put his arms around her, let her head rest against his chest, told her everything would be all right, and that he'd be back home before she knew it. He was going to be a Green Beret. They were smarter, tougher, and better warfighters than anybody. The next day, she drove him to the induction center in Waco. She found a parking spot, but as she started to get out, he put his hand on her arm, and he said to her, "Mom, let me go from here." He gave her a kiss on the cheek. Alone in her car, she sobbed for many minutes, just sitting in the car. Then she sniffled all the way home, through the night and into the next day. It was only getting back to work that was the distraction she needed to stop crying, let go, and move on. She said she hadn't been much of a prayerful person after high school, but every night before going to sleep, she knelt down beside her bed to pray for him and his safe return. Lizette falls silent, looking away and sighing, before standing up, wandering to the cabinet beside the refrigerator, and taking out a glass tumbler. She opens the freezer, grabs an aluminum ice tray, and cracks it open. She removes a few cubes and drops them into the glass so that they bounce around and make a clinking sound. Next, she reaches into another cabinet and pulls out a bottle of Jack Daniel's and unscrews the cap. She pours herself about 3 fingers on ice, caps the bottle, returns it to the cabinet, and takes a swig of the whiskey. Lizette returns to the kitchen table, unfolding her leg underneath her, sits down. She sips the Jack Daniel's and asks, "You hungry? I can fix you something if you like." "No, ma'am, I'm fine." "All right, then. Let's get you to your room." Feeling every one of her lifelong years, Lizette rises slowly, leaving her glass on the kitchen table, and walks out of the kitchen. I follow her. We walk down the hallway, past a linen closet and the open door to her bedroom. We stop at a closed door at the end of the hallway. She opens it, reaches in, and flips the light switch. It lights a room that is obviously a young man's bedroom. There are sports trophies displayed on shelves. Sports pennants from teams both far and near, including the University of Texas, hang on the walls. A large poster depicting a line of green berets standing at attention and offering a perfect salute to an American flag is prominently displayed on the wall opposite the twin bed. I look around, and before stepping in, I check with her. "This is your son's room. Are you sure it's okay?" "It's okay," she responds sadly. "He ain't home, and he ain't coming home." "Oh. What can I say to that?" "Nothing. There are no words that can soothe that kind of pain." "You don't have to say nothing." Almost as if she knows what I am thinking. "Just make yourself at home." "I would like that very much." I enter the room and put my things down on the bed. That last door on the right is the bathroom. Feel free. I have my own. You'll find everything that you need." "Thank you." A few minutes later, I am in the bathroom taking a hot shower, the first I've had in a couple of days. I need it. Finishing up, I towel off. There is a man's terry cloth robe hanging on a hook behind the door. As inviting as it looks, I decide instead to wrap a towel around my waist and dry myself off with another. I return to the room and put on clean underwear. Pulling down the bedspread, blanket, and sheet, I climb into bed. I lay on my back, cross my hands on my chest, and give myself time to think about all the things that had happened on this first day of my first adventure. I smile as all the thoughts of the interesting and helpful people I met along the way leaves little room for worrying about an upset brother Bartholomew or my angry mother. After a little while thinking those good thoughts of gratitude, I reach to switch off the lamp, roll over on my side, and close my eyes. So I think you're still processing at this point, but I kind of put on the thumbnail realization because I think this is the beginning of realization when we start to realize at this age, 14, 15 years old, we begin to realize we're still thinking very black and white, right and wrong, yes and no. The gray areas we haven't really figured out yet. We kind of figure those out when we're at college age more likely. But we do begin to see our parents in other people. Like, she reminds you of your mother. She's wearing the same kind of a house coat. She's barefoot. She's got the after work look. You know, this woman reminds me of my mother, is kind of the whole feeling that we're getting here. And that you're having a real conversation with a person who reminds you of your mother is unusual, because we don't have real conversations with our parents until we become adults, I think. for the most part, when we're teenagers and growing up, they tell us what to do, and we either do it or we don't. We don't have these deep questioning conversations until later in life. A lot of times our kids don't even know about, you know, us growing up. For instance, my daughter and my niece, when they were visiting before Kevin passed, they would ask me questions about their dad, his brother, who I went to school with, and Kevin, and what they were like when they were teenagers, and, you know, how we all met, and all of the, you know, those kinds of stories. But they're adults now. They wouldn't have thought to ask that when they were teenagers.
Yeah.
So I called it realization, but I think it's pre-realization. It's working its way into a realization of my mother's a real person, you know, that sort of segue between being a child and being an adult is when we start to discover the people in our lives are also people. They're also human beings. They're also full of fears and anxieties and emotions, and they have a lot, you know, going on in their lives, whereas we don't think of them that way until we get to be, you know, to a place where we say, oh, Lisette's just like my mom. Lisette's got all these issues, and, you know, she's lived this life, and she's had these problems, and she's worried about her son and all of this. And that's beginning to process.
My thinking is that up until that time, or up until the time we experience what you referred to as realization, that most of the people in our lives we perceive as actors. You're the actor that's my mother. You're the actor that's the principal of the school. You're the actor that's my...
Or roles.
Yeah, yeah.
These are the roles they play.
They're playing these mm-hmm. roles that are very necessary in your life in order to move you forward in a positive way. Now, there can be negative roles and negative actors in your life as well that could cause damage. And it sounds like she had experienced some of that, you know, in the relationship that she had long enough, you know, to produce a child. It isn't until later that you realize, as you said, that there are real people underneath those facades. And they didn't necessarily create the facade. The expectation of the role is set by you and what your role, you know, whatever your role is. You're the role of the rebellious son. And so you have a mother whose role is to correct that rebellious son without the recognition or, quote, realization, unquote, as you describe it, that there is a woman behind that facade that has a much broader life. It wasn't until later in life that I discovered, for example, that my mother had spent most of World War II working on airplanes on the West Coast. It wasn't until later that I discovered that she had attended and graduated from the Corcoran School of Art in Washington, D.C., and that she had gone there on a scholarship, a full scholarship, including travel, paid for by some rich person in Santa Fe that saw her as a talented artist. Mm. You know, so that was part of the what was behind the facade. For me, it was just the woman who was constantly nagging me about how wrong I was about everything without, you know, I mean, she was a certified teacher. So she had a lot going for her, and of course, a very talented artist. And it was always fun to go down to the plaza on Spanish Market Day and see, and this again, after I was older, see how much people who knew her admired her. And that was, you know, that was different in the sense that, oh my God, she's my mom, leave her alone. She'll just get bigger headed, you know, that kind of thing. And I think there was a certain amount of disappointment because I just wasn't following the lead. I didn't want to be an attorney like my father. I didn't want to be an artist like she was. And so she had a very, important role to play in my life. And that was, if you can't do the things that we expect of you, then at least do the things on the straight and narrow and don't screw yourself up. Now, my brothers and sisters didn't get the opportunity not to screw things up. And I always watched the role that she played for them. And the role that she played for them was more love, more attention, more forgiveness, more
enabling,
more ignoring, et cetera. And I could see it. I mean, I could watch it happen where I would say to myself, she would never let me do that. She would even consider, she wouldn't bail me out of jail. She would let me. She let me sit in jail the whole weekend once. And we're going to have to tell this. I do want to explain that. That sounded bad. It wasn't as bad as it sounded. So she had a different role that she was playing for my brothers and sisters that was, as you said, more enabling. And mine was, how do I control this rebellious kid who doesn't want to do anything I tell him? She was never enabling with me in the same way that she was with my brothers and sisters. And perhaps that was the difference, you know, the difference in how we grew up and spent our lives.
And I think you'll hear that from a lot of oldest children.
I agree. Yeah. I think that's probably true.
I'll say, you know, by the time it got to the baby, they let them run wild.
Yeah. Yeah. My brothers and sisters died in reverse order of their birth. The baby died first, and then my brother, and then my sister. And I'm still, the rebellious one is still here. So It's a very strange situation to be in. I was kind of surprised that we ended that chapter there. I thought we had gone into the next chapter, and I'm kind of glad now that we didn't.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot.
We wanted to separate the two out.
Yeah, there, because there's a lot to talk about in the next chapter.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons too. So, but this one is good. I mean, like you said, it's that awareness that there are people in the world who remind you of someone but aren't. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, there are people in the world who remind you of the roles of the people in your life that the people in your life play, and you'd expect that from her. And I'm sure to her son, she played the role of the doting, caring, hopeful mom. And to me, she was the very nice lady who ran a hamburger stand, invited me to her house without so much as a caution, and smoked cigarettes and drank Jack Daniels, you know, and walked around in her house coat and bare feet. I mean, you kind of get the sense that the fact that she had a stranger in her home didn't change her behaviors. Like, I'm okay with that.
Because you were like a son to her.
Yeah.
You were that age.
Yeah, that's what it felt. I get a sense that's what it felt like. Like, yeah. I was just being treated like a son. It continues through the next morning as well. So, yeah.
I think it's, you know, cool, because if you've seen any TV or movies based in the 60s, you can kind of get a whole idea of this house coat, which is just like that. It's a coat that zips up and it's like a robe, but it's not like a sexy robe.
They called
it's like a little old lady thing.
Yeah, with puffy shoulders. They all had puffy shoulders.
Yeah.
And short sleeves, and they were always flower prints. And I remember them calling it, and it, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, I thought they were referred to as muumuus.
No, muumuu is more like a dress.
Is it?
Yeah, like a big dress. The house coat was more like you put it on like a coat and then you zip it up.
Right. Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was baggy. It didn't show off anything, you know, and it went down to just below the knee. So I think that's why she could sit there because she was in her element, dressed the way that she wanted, and it's her house. And if she wants to smoke and drink in it, she can do that.
Yeah. So, I think, you know, on the thumbnail, I had, you know, the big Jack Daniels, and then the woman just kind of looking at, you know, out at people. I'm just like, and realization kind of, you know, maybe it was, oh, you know, maybe there's an element of sexuality to
and
this
mischievousness,
or something.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
really, it's just like mom and you know, a kid.
Yeah.
And just because you're not related doesn't mean you didn't act like a mom and a kid.
And even what happens in the next chapter is not intimate in a sexual way. It's intimate in a father, mother and a son way. So I never felt that way. I mean, admittedly, as you'll find out in the chapter, I did feel a little bit that way, but it was because of the situation, you know. So I still feel my only regret, pretty much with as is with most of the people in this story who were actual people, I never went back, you know. And it wouldn't have been hard. And so you wonder if they, and this is our natural self-centeredness, you wonder if they think about you, if they ever thought about you, like whatever happened to that boy that was riding that motorcycle across Texas, you know, whatever happened to him.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, lately I've been going through a lot of family pictures, you know, trying to whittle them down and get them, scanned into the computer so I'm not carrying around a bunch of boxes and boxes mm-hmm. of photos. The thing about that is I have to look at all of them, you know, and make the memories come back. And so it's kind of funny because I'm like, oh, yeah, we used to live in Arizona, you know, because, like, you just let things go and you forget about them until somebody asks you. Like I said, with my daughter and niece, when they asked me questions about, well, what was my dad like when, you know, in high school? And what did you guys, how did you meet? And what did you do? And it just kind of brings things all back. So that's like what she's doing here, I think, is she'd put these memories away because they were painful for her. And then Miguel is asking her all of these questions. And she's like, just answering truthfully because somebody asked. And so, of course, it brings up a lot of emotions. She relives the taking him to get signed up with the army and relives that whole, you know, I had this dream for my kid and it didn't come true and it didn't come true for me. And why doesn't anything, you know, work the way I planned it, kind of a thing. So there's a lot of emotions, and I think that whole squashed dream thing that comes up for her, which I think is why she goes to the cupboard for the Jack Daniels to kind of deal with her emotions, because she's not alone, so she's not going to just start bawling. There's somebody right there that she's trying to take care of help, crying in front of them isn't going to help the situation. So she drinks the whiskey and then says, why don't you go to bed? I can be alone.
Right. The other thing too, in the previous chapter, she expresses some concern about how this would make my mother feel. Like, what does she think about that? And of course I lied my way through brushing it off, you know, and I didn't have any context for why she should be so concerned about what my mother thinks about. You don't find out till later, of course, that her son did something similar to her, far more drastic, of course. But I think she understood the two sides of this. She understood what I was doing and probably why I was doing it, but she also understood my mother's side and how she must be feeling at this point, because by this point, my mother has probably found out from the Christian Brothers that I am not in school, I'm not in the boarding hall, and I'm nowhere to be found. So I would have missed my Saturday cleaning the hallway appointment. And that's when things
No, actually, we said you cleaned the...
Oh, no, no,
on
no.
On Saturday. This was... then Saturday evening you went to...
Right, that's right. I'm sorry.
Barbecue.
Yeah, that's right.
So she would... they would have looked for you in church. So
they would have looked for me at for choir.
Yeah.
Because we used to sing at the 9 o'clock mass at St. Michael's.
And you wouldn't have been there. Mm-hmm. And then it would have checked your bed, to see if you
were somebody would have had to notice. Right. Yeah. So
of course, your friend across the hall that we talked about.
Yeah, Dave. But he would have kept silent.
Yeah, but right.
He knew what was going on.
Like kidnapped,
right?
Or
yeah,
that you weren't sick. You had left.
If what would have happened is they would have come, and if anybody noticed, I would have been surprised if they had noticed at Mass. Like, because it's very busy, you're organized, it's busy in the sense that, and I wasn't like a lead singer, I was just one of the boys in the choir. So it might not have been at Mass, and I never did get the story about how it all came down. It was one of those things where I got back and it was just like high fives, you know, hey, bro. Yeah. You know? So I'm not sure how that whole process, I'm going to guess that it would have lasted until Monday morning when they did a bed check. So it might have happened then. I mean, there was always a late evening, late night bed check. But my guess is that probably by Monday morning, when I didn't appear in my classes.
Because they could have thought, well, he just went home for the weekend.
Well, there's that. But also, each of the teachers will have in their book, they will have a note from Brother, what do we call him? Brother Bartholomew, that's not his real name, that I was not going to be in attendance for this reason. Right. So I would have not shown up for class. There would have been an empty seat because we sat in the same seats every day in the classes that we went to. And somebody would have gone like, where's Eunice? You know, one of the brothers, brother Wayne, who was my religion teacher, was a first class. And so he would have asked like, where's everybody would have played dumb until they. It was, it was like a boys' school. We're not going to rat on anybody.
Yeah. And then, of course, unless they had to call your mom at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. They had to check and see if I was at home and, you know, things like that. But they would have never thought to call Carlos. She would have never thought to call Carlos. I mean, he would have told her the truth if she had called him, but I don't think she would have thought of that. It would all have been between her and the Christian Brothers, because at this point, it's something to do with religion and, you know.
Well, I'm sure she would have started calling around to everybody.
She would have called around to the local, like my grandma and my Aunt Lucy and people like that, Mundi, the people that were living in Santa Fe, to see if I had done. Because they were all, I mean, Santa Fe was a small town. Mm-hmm. There is nothing that would have prevented me from walking to any one of my relatives' house that I wanted to do that. Carlos, on the other hand, was in Abiquiú, which was not as easy. So she would have never thought of that. She would have never, she wouldn't have thought of Carlos, and she wouldn't have thought of Taos, where the Eunice side of the family was. Mm-hmm. It would have all been right there. And she knew that I had expressed independence by spending weekends up in the mountains above Santa Fe on my motorcycle. And so I had that sense of, I don't think it was adventure. I could look down the mountains and see Santa Fe, you know. So she knew that there might have been some of that. There was a lot of options here. Mm-hmm. She would have probably called the police to make sure they didn't find a little boy body someplace.
Yeah.
And that was before my brothers and sisters were expressing themselves in their own forms of rebelliousness, which were far worse than anything I ever did. And so all she had to worry about was three little kids that still needed attention and being fed and those kinds of things. So
there's beginnings of a recognition. Mm-hmm. I think throughout the entire book, it increases. Mm-hmm. It's the coming of age story arc, a hero's journey of understanding that you're not the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. These actors in your life are actually really people with feelings and concerns of their own.
And stories of their own.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you're describing, that moment in time. And it doesn't, of course, hit you. We don't have the luxury of it just popping into your head one day. It takes time. It takes doing something like this and running into a variety of people. Up until that point, the people that I had engaged were people in Santa Fe, people in my family, people in the Catholic Church, because I went to Catholic schools my entire life. Altar boys, you know, I was an altar boy, et cetera, et cetera. So these were people that were extremely different from the experiences that I had to this point. And I think that was a good thing in the sense that as you said, there's that recognition that there's other kinds of people out there in the real world or on the outside world in this case, and B, you're seeing them with the actor defense, right? She wasn't acting. She was being her. The sheriff wasn't acting. He was being him. The bikers weren't acting. Up until that point, you thought everybody was acting around you, and because of that teenager sense of the universe thing, like, they're just trying to make my life miserable, you know, depending on who it was.
Yeah.
But I think the experience that he had with Carlos, the experience that he had with the bikers, the experience that we had with the sheriff, and now the experience he's having with Lizette, were all ways to explain, like, this is the real world. This isn't that made-up world of boarding school and angry moms that you've been creating for yourself. You know, I think after this, I can honestly say, although it would never came around to perfection, my mother and I were always at loggerheads with one another for a variety of reasons, but I had more respect for her. And I always wondered, well, did she have more respect for me? I always imagined, nah, she still thinks I'm a schmush, you know? But I think she did. And then something would happen way later in life, you know, that she, it would remind me, like, no, I'm still her rebellious one, even at age 50, you know?
Yeah, all the men and women are merely players. Is that all the world's a stage?
Shakespeare.
That's how I think that's very apropos, especially for young people, and that we feel like all the world is a stage and everybody in it is just acting their role,
including us as children and teenagers.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the rebellious teenager, and so I got to play that role. I'm going to do whatever I can to play that role and hope it doesn't land me in jail. So,
well, and I think how you said something has to happen before we really examine something. So, for instance, all these pictures that I'm going through, they were sitting in boxes for years and years and years, right? I never thought to let's pull them out and scan them. But now that it's like, oh, I'm going to be moving soon. I don't want to carry a bunch of pictures around with me. Let me scan them. Well, you know, something had to happen to get me to that point where I'm now going through everything and I'm finding, like, you know, CDs with pictures and having to sort through this stuff. And it's a lot of work. And I'm like, no wonder I didn't want to do it, you know, but there's got to be a motivating factor, something that pushes you into it.
The thing that I discovered, because I was a lifelong photographer, right? And we didn't get into the digital age where we could share them in a digital way until by the time it was the mid-90s was when it really got regular, you know?
Well, even that was, they weren't very good pictures if they were digital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I had the same experience. Like, I have boxes of slides. I have a couple of boxes of photos, not as much as, including, you know, I was reminded today when we were watching that short film of the gentleman that had been in Vietnam as an 11 Bravo grunt, and he had an 8mm camera, you know, and the History Channel borrowed that material and said, we don't have a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, that box that I'm talking about sitting over in storage right now is filled with photographs of my time in Vietnam. And my first reaction is, oh, man, I have to get those on something and scan them. And the problem is nobody cares.
I wouldn't say that.
If I were to offer them to my children, they would say,
If it's a lot of work, they wouldn't want to do it. But if you got the pictures, scanned them, and then had some kind of a video that you made with those photos, people would be interested. Maybe not your kids because they're just too close to it. But maybe they would be. I know when you did that interview with your grandson about it, that your daughter was like, oh, I didn't know that, you know, because, like, again, it takes something to push it, something to motivate those questions and that learning. Otherwise, we just don't think to do it. But Griffin asking you those questions and her listening in on the conversation, she was like, why haven't I ever asked you these things before?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was funny when about a month ago, when I wanted to let her know that we were thinking about moving, her first reaction to that was, Now I wish I had spent more time with you.
Yeah.
While you were here.
Yeah, that motivation.
Yeah.
We don't, you know, we live day to day putting out fires and surviving, and we don't plan ahead on certain, you know, we plan ahead on like business stuff because we have to make a living. But when it comes to our personal lives, we don't plan ahead. We just live in the moment and hope for the best. But when it comes to a point where somebody's moving or somebody's having a baby, somebody's getting married, somebody's graduating, some event is taking place, then we're like suddenly aware of all the time that's passed that we haven't spent together, right? Uh-huh. So we're calling our friends and we're saying, we need to spend some time together before we move. We, you know, gotta do this. So we're starting to do that more, because you just don't, especially after the pandemic, you know, or it's like you weren't even allowed to go see them, or, you know, you had to be safe so you couldn't go see your friends. So we got out of the habit of getting together we used to get together once a month with Sean and Sue.
Yeah.
Easily. Now it's like, if we get together once or twice a year,
we're lucky,
you know? Yeah, exactly. So it's like, I guess it's a good reminder that don't wait for somebody to pass away. Don't wait for somebody to move. Don't wait for somebody to have a big event to do something about, you know, your life, your relationships. Really, you know, you got to maintain relationships. They require maintenance, just like a car or a house. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're going to fall apart too.
Right. Yeah. So I'm trying to imagine or trying to conjure up the differences between my perspective of photographs, physical photographs, you know, analog photographs, versus my children's digital, because if it isn't digital, if they can't look at it on their phone, like I couldn't send them an album, right? Here's an album of all of the pictures of you growing up. And as a matter of fact, Laura had collected all of those pictures of them as kids. And when they burned, Laura was apologetic, like, I wish that hadn't happened. And they all went, we're okay with it, Mom.
Yeah.
Like they didn't have a lot of their childhood pictures. And I think mostly it's because there's a point at which people, the human species, decided that the extent of their memory as required by whatever is in their future is the last 2 months. Wrong. And I don't have to worry about anything before that. If I want to see, it's like me and my baby pictures every night. I want to see today's pictures. Mm-hmm. It's rare that I go back and look at last week's pictures.
Yeah.
It's today.
Which is why they do the stories instead of the longer ones.
What happens today? That's what I want to know. Who were they with today? Where were they today? And digital communications allows me to take that stored in my memory banks, as limited as my memory banks are, and I don't have to worry about organizing pictures or scanning pictures.
There's, of course, a couple of problems with that. Some of those, we pulled out some Fermis, the little discs. They had, you know, they may have, if they'd had pictures on them,
we don't know because
we can't access it.
Yeah.
Even film is really hard to access. If you had a roll of film where
you have to send it off.
It'd be really hard to process that. You know, there's all these different formats that is no longer used. So you have to continue to update how they're stored. So I had them on CDs. I'm like, no, I want them on a hard drive, right? So I'm doing that now. And then as you do that, you have to go through them and go, are these even worth keeping?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is better than having boxes and boxes of photos.
I'd rather have a digital version,
of course. But with the analog boxes of photos, if you can make photo albums, which, you know, I have, and, you know, I took that to my mom because she can no longer scroll through a phone. Mm-hmm. She can't figure out how to do things because, you know, she's got brain damage from a stroke, but she can look through a photo album, and so can little kids,
right?
You know, little ones who can't yet figure out, you know, mouse and scrolling, and I mean they learn that pretty young, but to have photos that they could sit there and look through. I know my daughter was Just love that. She just loved. She did not want to read a book twice, but if it was a photo album, she'd look at that every day. So we can't lose those things, you know. Take the best of the best and put them in a book so that somebody can look through them. And they'll always, you always have that backup, you know, on the hard drive. And, but if that hard drive crashes, they're gone.
They're gone.
So it's just like,
that's why you're in the cloud. But if Google takes away your cloud storage, then they're gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I was thinking about something. So I had the same problem. I have containers, plastic containers in storage of media that if I wanted the material off that media, I would have to find somebody to do it for me.
Yeah.
You know, I would have to pay somebody to do that.
You can no longer access it.
Yeah. Well, the digital, we were talking about the digital, the first digital tapes. Those are digital tapes. They're very usable because they're zeros and ones as opposed to a signal. But now you got to find, I went looking after we talked about it. I went looking for one of those Sony recorder players and they were high end at the time. Mm-hmm. At that time, they were an $800 product, right? Can't find them anywhere.
No.
Went to eBay, went to their
the only places that have them are the places that do that as a business now.
And there's one in Albuquerque. There is one, and thankfully there's one in Albuquerque. And I noticed there were several businesses advertising, send us your box of photos and we'll digitize them for. And there was a point at which even during the pandemic, I thought, well, that's what people are going to do. And then suddenly those businesses weren't advertising anymore. I don't know if they still exist or they're so loaded with business they don't have to advertise. But it was, if you have a box of, you know, material, whether it's a VHS tape or whatever, and you want to digitize that onto a DVD or something, send it to us and they send you a box. Here's the box. This box costs, fill this box, and it's a fixed price for the box. Whatever you can get into it. So I thought it was a good business model, but I haven't seen much of it recently.
Yeah. I've been going through the VHSs and I'm just like, nope, never watched it in 25 years. Why would I keep it now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why would I go ahead and get it transferred over into something digital? I haven't watched it in 25, 30 years.
I had some CDs it was digital.
Yeah.
Of movies that I had made that when the girls were at school and, you know, or dance class and do that. And I started taking them. And since they were digital, it was easy to make a YouTube video and let them know that, hey, you remember that time you played Elvis Presley in your school talent show? And they'd say, yeah, we saw, I'd send an email. Hey, check this out. You know, this is that year you guys won the state championship in field hockey, et cetera. And it would get 4 views.
Yeah.
So
what does that teach us?
That teaches us that we should take every photograph, every memory that's analog in form, and just drop it off at the dump and use the plastic storage containers for something else.
It also teaches us to live in the moment, to fully enjoy and immerse ourselves in the moment rather than putting a phone in between us and them, because who's going to watch that video or look at those photos after the event's over anyway? If you're not present in that moment, you've missed it.
Well, the other thing that digital has done for us is it's made it, before you used to have to buy film and then you used to have to pay to have the film processed. When we were putting together Kevin's memorial, I had a lot of photos from the time that we were searching for the Fenn treasure. And there's a folder on one of my external hard drives that has Fenn treasure travels, something like that. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I did was find all the JPEGs. There were 45,000 pictures. Yeah. 45,000, because it doesn't cost anything to process. You can press that button as many times as you want.
That's right. And a lot of times it is the same thing.
Yeah, well, it is. It's, you know, as an experienced photographer who is getting paid and digital video maker, if you had a chance to take a shot, you didn't take one shot. You took 5, 10, or as many as you could fit in.
Mm.
And then from that, you pick the one that was best.
Yeah.
Editing.
But it's the sorting that takes forever.
Oh, it does. Well, even now, I don't know. It took me, a day and a half to go through all the photos that I shot on my smartphone, no less, at the wedding. And I'd go through them and I'd say, okay, well, this gives me the opportunity to pick the best one or the one where everybody's eyes are open. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I always take a backup shot of almost every picture I take anyway, you know.
Most people do.
Well, me, I take 10 or 12.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So be in the moment and talk to your family members. If there's somebody in your family who is getting on in years, and I was going to do this, and I'm so unhappy that it didn't happen. For my mom's 80th birthday, we were going to do an interview with mm-hmm. her, yeah. So, you know, ask her and have her sit down with her older sister so the two of them could answer the questions together, because then they could bounce back and forth between their memories together. And, you know, just what was it like growing up, and, you know, what school did you go to, and, you know, tell us about your life, things like that. And we wanted to do that for her 80th birthday. And then she had the stroke. And it just became impossible to do.
We have a friend.
And then the same thing with Kevin.
Yeah.
He couldn't talk.
Yeah.
So we couldn't really do an interview
to document.
He was either in pain or he just couldn't speak.
And it would have been hard. It would have been hard to convince him that it was important for him to do it anyway.
I asked him, why don't you write a letter to each of your children? Well, he never did. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, don't wait, just do it. You know, don't wait for their 80th birthday. Do it now. You know,
we should create a quote, like, what's the most important time in your life? The answer is the present.
Yeah. Right now.
Yeah.
And if you miss it,
it's gone.
And I mean, even if you took a video of it, you're not going to go back and watch it, because people just don't, they just don't want to spend the time on something if it's not live and in front of them. They're not excited to go back and look at it.
My hope is that if after I pass and my children are sitting down someplace and they say, boy, I sure miss Dad, what can we do to kind of bring it back? And one of them will say, well, he's got 10,000 videos on YouTube.
That's
Let's
right.
go look at those.
That's so. Right. He's telling all kinds of stories.
Yeah.
And that's right. And I interview you and you interview me. So our stories are out there. And if, you know, if that's something that you want to do, if you want to get your story out there on YouTube, it's not that hard, you know, give us a call, write to us.
And, we have courses.
How to do that.
We've done it for people. We have a course that you could take on Udemy. But honestly, if you'd give yourself a couple of hours, in phone conversation or a Zoom call, you can learn what needs to be done. It ain't rocket science.
Leave a legacy behind for the family that is going to wonder about all these things once you've passed, and then they'll have a way to access that information.
Yeah. At least you hope they do. They might just go like, he's dead. Let's move on.
Yeah.
But
if they had the opportunity, I think they would.
I'm actually not sure.
Yeah.
I think out of sight, out of mind.
I don't know. I mean, I've gone through a lot of photos in the last couple of months, so. And told stories to people.
Hmm.
And people told me stories. So I think we do that as part of
the grieving process.
The grieving process, reprocessing our emotions and our memories and getting to a place where we feel okay with moving on into the future. So
I want people to know that as you see Shelley and I having these deep and almost intimate conversations about our lives and what we do, you might think to yourself, well, they do this for the show and they don't do it any. No, we talk like this all day long. We just have these conferences.
That's right, we do. So, but we like having this excuse to get really deep, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
Once a week.
Yeah, I go back and watch the video and I go like, where did I come up with that? I was telling Shelley. Sometimes I feel like I make this stuff up as we're going along, you know?
Yeah. Well, all right. So next week we're going to continue our story with Miguel and Lizette and see what happens. And I have to warn you, it's pretty
steamy.
Steamy, exciting, different than what you might have expected. So I hope that you'll tune in for that next week.
That should do it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for joining us today to learn more about Lizette and Miguel and Shelley and Toby. And we hope to see you again next week.
Yeah, we do.
Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story, because your story matters.